This is an ABC podcast.
250 metres to go. Fine Cotton still the leader. He's about a neck in front. Harbour Gold's
in the three eastern states have shown at least 10 people are principal figures in the Fine Cotton ring-in.
The swap appeared to have been well organised.
Inquiry into the Fine Cotton
substitution could have netted more than $1 million for those who planned it.
Those will happen to the real Fine Cotton.
I fear the worst, but naturally hope for the best for the horse itself anyway.
On August the 18th, 1984, a race was held at Eagle Farm Racecourse in Brisbane. Now, this was supposed to be a low-key affair, but people at the track that day noticed that the race was attracting an unusual amount of attention, that the punters were following the race with a kind of furtive intensity. It was weird. The winner by half a nose was a fifth-rate galloper known as Fine Cotton. Now, Fine Cotton had run a bunch of races and had always placed at the back of the field, and yet somehow, on this day, it had won. But then a bunch of men, strategically placed at the finish line, started shouting, "Ring in! Ring in!" Because Fine Cotton was not Fine Cotton at all. He was another horse entirely. A much better horse, disguised, and I use that term loosely, to look like Fine Cotton. And so an incredibly complicated plot to defraud bookmakers of millions of dollars began to unravel. This was a plot that was more like a farce descending into an outright fiasco, one of the greatest fiascos in our sporting history. It's a tale that involves a brutal Sydney gangster, a hapless trainer, a bucket of hair dye, and an unsuspecting horse. Peter Hoisted is a crime writer and a columnist for The Australian, where he writes under the name of Jack the Insider. And I'm going to call him Jack because I've known him for some years, and that's what I always call him. Now, I have to confess, I don't follow racing, so I missed all this at the time. But then one day, Jack explained the whole debacle to me, and it was then that I realised the full enormity of the hoax that had been perpetrated on that day back in 1984. Now Jack's co-written a book with Pat Scheel on the whole ghastly story, and it's called The Fine Cotton Fiasco. Hello, Jack.
G'day, Richard. How are you, mate?
Well, Jack, I feel like we should be doing this in the pub with the sticky carpet, Jack. I'm sorry to bring you into the ABC.
Yes, it should be. I mean, and this story, there's a lot of beer consumed as we go through this. All the conspirators were heavy drinkers. And in a sense, when things started falling apart, they'd just drink that little bit more.
This is a story with a bit of tragedy, but more than a fair bit of farce, as I said, Jack. Just how farcical was it in your eyes?
Well, it's like Give Me That Thing should have been played on the kazoo for the months before in the planning and preparation of this. This was a comedic farce. Look, originally, it might have worked, but there was just one tragic event that just brought this all into the realms of comedy.
Let's just go back a few steps here, Jack. Had anyone tried to ring in a horse in a race in Australia before?
Oh, there's a rich history of this, Richard. In the 30s in racing around Australia, there was a horse called Irby, who had 23 wins under his own name, but may have won as many as 12 races under other horses' names. And Irby was often dyed to make him look like the horses that he was set to ring in for. So there was that going back to the 30s. There was one of our principals in this story is a fellow by the name of John Gillespie. He had tried a ring in 1982 in Queensland, putting in apparent heir as Manison, and that was rumbled. There was a very famous one in 1972 in Victoria with another used car salesman, funnily enough, by the name of Rick Renzella, who swapped a horse called Royal School for a picnic nag called Regal Vista. And Rick Renzella was ultimately jailed and barred for tracks for life. But cruelly on that occasion, Royal School, the horse, was actually banned for life as well.
Like the horse had done something wrong.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, that's the way it was. But this had reached a rather serious element in 1983 when a Queensland trainer, George Brown, was found murdered. And it was believed that he had refused to be part of a ring-in. I'm not suggesting for a moment that was the same conspiracy as those who were involved in Fine Cotton, but this fellow was murdered for not being involved in a ring-in. And clearly some very serious criminals had got involved in the business of race-fixing generally and thought a ring-in might give them some more money.
When we come to the fine cotton plot, Jack, where was this hatched? Where do we find the origins of this plot?
John Gillespie, who I mentioned before, was doing a stretch in jail for dishonesty offences. It was in Boggo Road, the old Boggo Road jail in Queensland, and he had chanced across a fellow by the name of Pat Hyatana and a number of associates of a Sydney criminal by the name of Mick Sayers. And at Boggo Road, it's believed that they hatched the plan then to buy a picnic nag, replace it with a more expensive horse that looked similar to it, and run with it.
Once they got out of jail, they needed to bring a trainer in to make the scam work. Who did they bring in, Jack?
Well, Pat's brother, Hayden Hyatana, was brought in. I mean, that was part of the plan, that Hayden would be the person who would do it.
So how did they find the horses required for the ring-in?
Well, Gillespie had been involved in the horse racing business, and he had found two horses that were identical. And the first was Fine Cotton, which he picked up for $1,000. And the second was Dashing Saltaire, which he bought for $10,000.
Fine Cotton's the picnic nag, as you say.
Yes.
But Dashing Saltaire is the lookalike that's going to be brought in, and that's the one that's going to win the race. That's the plan at this stage.
That's the one. So Fine Cotton is basically a Class 3 novice, and Dashing Saltaire was a Group 2 horse. So it's about three or four grades higher than Fine Cotton, and they looked identical. I mean, almost identical. To the passing eye, at least, they were the same horse.
Tell me about the horse Fine Cotton itself, given that its name is right at the centre of all this. What kind of a horse was Fine Cotton, Jack?
It had had a couple of wins at the time this all blew up. It was 9 years of age in 1984, so it was really at the end of a long and unillustrious sort of racing career. 70 starts for a couple of wins. So this was a horse that was a trier. That's about as much as you'd expect. And at 9 years of age, you wouldn't expect it to do much of anything, really. It's rare that you see a nine-year-old horse running around.
Given that the whole point of this is you're going to run a much better horse in place of a dud horse, is the point, first of all, to drive the betting price down then on the dud horse? And if so, how did they do that with Fine Cotton, Jack?
Oh, well, this is part of the plan, that Fine Cotton, they firstly flogged it in training, so it was never going to run well at a race. And then they just race it before the ring-in repeatedly. I think it had something like 9 starts in about 30 days. So this is an extraordinary amount of racing for a horse of its age. And they did this so it would finish at the back of the field, finish last, finish 10th, finish 8th, finish 9th, never in the placing. And obviously its price would go down.
Did it ever look like placing in any case, in any of these early races, set-up races, Jack?
Well, after the syndicate had organised this, they looked on in horror at the Bundamba races one day. Fine Cotton loomed at the turn in front. And I mean, that would have been an absolute disaster. Had it won or even placed, that would have meant that its price would move upwards. So, you can only imagine what Hayden Hyatana thought when Fine Cotton, who'd been just basically raced and trained to exhaustion, has loomed at the turn in front and looked like taking the race. But happily for Hayden and the syndicate, it returned to form and finished 10th.
This is starting to sound a bit like springtime for Hitler, Jack, isn't it? You know, where the producers want to put on an absolute dead-set misfire flop musical so they can defraud their investors. Similarly, Fine Cotton has to not just run last, but be seen to run last again and again and again.
Yeah, that's right. So it was a failure, and it had to be proven as a failure as we went forward. This is still a very good plan, by the way. Everyone was behind the plan, and as I say, Dashing Saltaire was sitting in the background being trained and being prepared for this race, and it was the spitting image of Fine Cotton.
So everything's set to go. They've got the spitting image horse. What went wrong?
Well, this is the great disaster. This was where a possible success turned into this comic farce and ultimate tragedy for a great many people. The horse Dashing Saltaire was in training, and it cut its hind quarters on barbed wire. It was quite a deep cut, and it had to be stitched up. And this was just a week out before it was due to run. That meant it could not run. It would not pass a vet inspection. It could not run like that. And so these men who were sitting back thinking, how they were going to spend their fortunes a week later, are sitting around in a pub in the Goldie, in the Gold Coast, and they get the news that Dashing Saltaire's out. It cannot race. John Gillespie gets up from his seat and goes and makes a phone call to Sydney, to the gangster Mick Sayers, and returns ashen-faced and says to the table, someone's going to get knocked over this.
Knocked, you mean punched in the head, killed.
Someone is going to be murdered. Someone is going to be murdered. Mick Sayers had invested his money. He was a man in desperate straits himself who owed a lot of money to a lot of people. And when he was told, oh, look, you know, the ring-in won't happen when it's supposed to, he said if it didn't proceed, people would be murdered. So they realised they have to make plan B. They've got no plan B, but they have to come up with one.
Let's get into Mick Sayers, this Sydney gangster who was bankrolling the whole scheme. Tell me about him. What kind of a man, what kind of a gangster was Mick Sayers, Jack?
Well, he was an inveterate punter. He was considered the largest punter in Sydney for a long, long time. He was Melbourne-born and came up to Sydney, like a lot of Melbourne crooks did, and found it very hard to get on. Sayers was constantly in and out of debt. He lived the high life. He lived in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. He drove around in a Mercedes-Benz. He was always losing a lot of money, and he tended to supplement his income by selling heroin. And that's the sort of man he was. He wasn't up there with the Nettie Smiths or the Chris Flannerys of this world, but he was certainly brutal enough, and certainly brutal enough if push came to shove. At the time of the ring-in, he owed a great amount of money to SP bookmakers around Sydney. And in that environment, the SPs, most of them at least, were under the aegis of George Freeman. And George Freeman was a gangster himself.
Was Mick Sayers a killer, Jack?
Yes, he was. Yeah, yes. He had been involved in murders. He certainly had prior knowledge of them. He was a pretty willing sort of fellow.
So this puts enormous pressure suddenly on the conspirators to come up with a replacement for the replacement. What kind of solutions were they coming up with, Jack, as they sat round that gloomy table in the pub on the Gold Coast?
The thing that marks this syndicate is they were always drinking. They were always having a stubby or having a beer in the pub. And so there they were, having a beer in this pub on the Gold Coast and tossing around ideas. And Hayden Hayatana's first idea was to give Fine Cotton what he called a bomb. And a bomb was this sort of ghastly amphetamine tablet that he would give to the horse in the hope that it would somehow find the form of a five-year-old and go up a couple of classes and win the race. But this was quickly dismissed by Gillespie. And it was determined that Gillespie would go back to a horse that he had had a look at in the previous year, not so much for a ring-in, but to buy on behalf of someone else. And that horse was Bold Personality, who was owned and trained by Bill Naum, who was based in Coffs Harbour. And they thought they'd do that. But there's one basic problem that they must have considered, but in the end they settled on it. And that big problem was that Bold Personality had absolutely... it was a completely different horse. It was a different colour, it was a different size, it had different markings. It looked like a dog to a cat. I mean,
right.
it was completely dissimilar.
Life is great in the Sunshine State. Every Queensland heart sings a song. To its tablelands and its golden sands, we are proud to say we belong. And our faith is great in the Sunshine State.
So, how many days out were they from the race meeting that this needed to happen in, Jack? Does this explain their desperate attempts to bring in Bold Personality as the ring-in?
Yes, well, they were due to do the ring-in on the Wednesday prior to the 18th, and they had to delay. They had to delay just the 4 days to the Saturday meeting. So they had that time to delay, but they were told there would be no delays beyond that permitted, and that meant violence. So Gillespie wrote a dud cheque and gave it to one of the conspirators, a man by the name of Tom DeLuzio, and sent him down to Coffs Harbour with a horse float on the back of an old Toyota Corolla, of all things. And with this dud cheque, he would buy the horse, Bold Personality, and pick it up and take it back to Brisbane, where they would prepare it. They had no time to train it. They just had to get it ready for the race and ring it in for Fine Cotton.
So these are men who are doing this, first of all, for $1 million. Now they're doing it for $1 million and because they're in fear of their lives.
Yes.
You mentioned that Mick Sayers was the gangster who was bankrolling the fine cotton ringing. He went to see a man called George Freeman, also known at the time, as I recall, Jack, as a, quote, colourful Sydney businessman. Mm. Why did he go to George Freeman?
Well, Freeman was the power in Sydney racing, shall we say, in the back blocks of it anyway. He had a network of SP bookmakers that operated under him and under his aegis. So if they were owed lots of money, then Freeman would collect the money on their behalf, often with threats of violence. He ran casinos in Sydney, in and around Sydney, in Wollongong, in Albury as well. He made a great deal of money from the illegal gaming business, as it was then, and he was a force to be reckoned with. In the Sydney scene, in the 70s and 80s, there were three very powerful men. One was Len McPherson, the other one was Stan Smith, and the third man was George Freeman. And this sort of triumvirate ran the old traditional rackets of illegal gaming, prostitution, money lending, casinos, that sort of thing.
I remember George Freeman, he used to appear on TV specials on Four Corners or something like that in the 1970s and 90s, 80s, Jack. And he was often presented as this kind of likeable rogue, a handsome devil with white hair, in a white suit, living in a mansion in Yowie Bay, driving an expensive car with a sort of affable sort of attitude. Was that what he was really like, Jack?
No, he was capable of great violence. And indeed, he committed at least two murders in his life. Like McPherson and Smith, they were products of boys' homes. They, in their childhoods, had accelerated levels of criminal development, so they found their way into boys' homes, places like Gosford, places like Mittagong Boys' Home, and they found their way into these places often at 12 and 13. So the rest of the kids in these places were 15 and 16 and a bit older. And they were subject to physical and sometimes sexual violence perpetrated on them, sometimes by the boys, sometimes by the guards. These places were basically criminal breeding grounds, and Freeman, McPherson and Smith rose through that. There were many others as well. Nettie Smith was another man who counted Mittagong Boys' Home and Gosford as his alma mater. There were many of them, and it basically gave them, well, by the time they reached adulthood, they were very, very violent men bent on revenge on society in general.
So are you saying that the thing that all these really senior and vicious criminals had in Australia was that they had all been subject to some degree of sexual abuse in a boys' home as a kid? You can
almost
see a connection there, an obvious connection there between that and their later careers as very angry men who were prepared to kill to get their way.
Almost without exception. Len McPherson used to talk publicly about being sexually abused by guards when he was at Gosford. Stan Smith went through there. Nettie Smith went through there. Even if we go down to Melbourne and look at Chris Flannery, the Morning Star Boys' Home, he was subject to physical and sexual violence at these places as a young boy, 14, 15 years of age. And what it did was just make them incredibly violent. They would often go and get pinched as adults, and they would spend brief periods in jail as adults. Freeman was one of those, was one such. And by the time they hit their mid-20s, they were violent as all get out. And they were, I guess, it's been explained to me, they'd been victims themselves, and they were determined for the rest of their lives they would never be victims again. Other people would be victims.
So George Freeman fought his way to the top of the tree and SP bookmaking and associated criminal enterprises around it at the time. Did he have a history of race fixing himself, Jack?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was said that in the 70s and 80s that there wasn't a race day where there wasn't a race fixed. And just to specify, he often worked in harness racing. It was harness racing, the old trots, as they say, where he did most of his work. And it's a bit simpler there, where you basically just offer, if there's eight horses in the harness racing field, he will offer seven of them $50 on the winning horse, which if it gets up at 8-1, everyone gets $400. They're not all that keen to race, and they're not likely to say no to George Freeman. So he basically almost ruined harness racing as a sport in this country. It was that bent.
So we've got these fine cotton conspirators operating at a kind of lower level, if you like, in the criminal world. One level above them is Mick Sayers, the guy who's bankrolling it, and above him is George Freeman. Why did Mick Sayers go to tell George Freeman about the plot to have a ring-in for Fine Cotton?
Well, Mick owed money to the SPs that operated under George Freeman's umbrella.
How much money was he into them for?
Well, there's talk of somewhere between half a million and a million and a half at the time. And he was always chasing his tail as a punter. So it was not unusual that he had a lot of money outstanding, but the situation had become quite grim for him. So one imagines that when he spoke to Freeman and told him about this conspiracy, the Fine Cotton ring-in, that he told Freeman to court favour with him and also to tell him, look, once this is done, everyone will get paid and everyone will be happy.
Nothing but blue skies ahead. Then if the ring-in works, blue skies ahead.
And like a lot of these crooks, Mick Sayers was unable to see through what would happen if it didn't work. But Freeman was a different character. He was very, very bright. He was very intelligent, very cunning and very shrewd. And when Sayers spoke to him and told him about this, he knew exactly what he was going to do in very quick time.
So the conspirators arranged to buy Bold Personality down somewhere in Coffs Harbour with a dud check.
Dud check.
Why? Because they didn't have enough money to pay what the 10 grand it would cost.
That was it. That was the end of their money. So they send this Tom DeLucio down to pick it up. The idea was to pay the owner, Bill Nahum, with the dud check. And by next week, of course, blue skies, as you say, so they'd be able to sort it all out and there wouldn't be any problem. Terribly sorry, we just didn't have enough funds in the account at the time. I could have sworn it would have been okay, but here's some cash, Bill. And that was the plan. They'd just buy this horse with a dud check and bring it up. The horse, just to repeat myself, that looked nothing like Fine Cotton.
All right. So now they've got to get the horse to Brisbane from Coffs Harbour. How did they do that, Jack?
Well, I believe it was a Toyota Corolla pulling a horse float. So that's the start of this farce, you know, this sort of car jerking up the Princes Highway up towards Brisbane. And DeLucio knew nothing about horses. It was August, a time of heat and humidity, often in the New South Wales and North Coast and in Queensland. And so he just threw a rug over the horse, and it was a winter rug. And so this horse, poor old Bold Personality, by the time it got to Brisbane, it was badly dehydrated.
So what happened when Hayden Haitana saw the horse, this poor dehydrated horse?
Yeah, well, they're in this position from which there is no turning back, and there is no ringing vets either, because vets are going to cotton on, no pun intended, to what's going on. So Haitana was a pretty good judge of horse flesh, and he would have seen that the horse was severely dehydrated, and he decided to do what a vet would normally do under this circumstance, and that is to flush the horse. And that involves rather rough it sounds, but putting a garden hose down one of the horse's nostrils, Bold Personality's nostrils, and filling its belly full of water. And you have to do this with great care, of course, unless you put water into the horse's lungs. But they were able to do it with some degree of success. Bold Personality was rehydrated. And as they removed the hose from its nostril, you're talking about 2 or 3 metres of hose here, it burst a blood vessel in its nose. I mean, horses and bleeding, it just can't happen anywhere near race time. So they decide that they have to stop the bleeding. And so they strap poor old Bold Personality's head to the rafters of the stable, as you might, if you get a blood nose yourself, sort of throw your head back. They basically strapped it to the rafters, this poor thing, and waited for the bleeding to stop that way. And then, of course, they had to deal with the colour.
Fine Cotton was a chestnut sort of colour or something, Jack, is that right?
Dark brown, almost black.
And what colour was Bold Personality?
It was a bay gelding, so that's a sort of light brown. I mean, we're talking chalk and cheese here.
So what did they do about that?
Well, this is, I guess, for people who know broadly the story, this is the bit that they will know. John Gillespie actually went around to a number of chemist shops around Brisbane, around near Haitana stables, and bought up as many henna rinse packets that women would dye their hair with. It was all henna. He'd buy 2 packets at one chemist shop, 3 at another, and he came back with enough for a 1,000-kilogram horse. And so there they were with half a dozen men with rubber gloves on, rubbing henna rinse Interbowl personality to try and make it a darker colour so it would look a bit like fine cotton, enough at least to pass muster.
How did Bold Personality look the next day?
The thing that they had not considered is that horsehair physiology and human hair physiology is quite different. And so basically the dye didn't take. So when Hayatana got into the stable the next day, Bold Personality was bright red. I mean, Elizabeth the First Bont's redhead. It was a jinger. This when you're trying to slip a horse through and ring it in, this was going to stand out. You know, bright red horses, people noticed them.
Was it like an equine traffic light, was it?
Yes, that's right.
On your mobile. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
They had a bright red horse on their hands.
What did they do about that?
Well, they decided sensibly that they were just going to go to plan C, I suppose, and that was... Firstly, they were going to get the horse around to one of the conspirators' homes, a fellow by the name of Robert North. He came from a well-to-do sort of Queensland family involved in the real estate business. And there, if passers-by and people driving their cars had seen the North residence, they would have seen a red horse standing in the front yard being hosed down and with all this dye running off it. That's what they did. So they were just thought, well, we know there's a huge difference between Bold Personality and fine cotton. And we're just going to go with that. We're just going to throw ourselves on the mercy of the stewards, basically. So they hosed the horse down.
But Jack, fine cotton had white socks, and Bold Personality did not. What were they going to do about that?
Oh, easily fixed. Richard, Hayden Hayatana presented with a spray of Dulux White High Gloss, and proceeded to spray the very wet Bold Personality with these, get these socks in there. But all that did was just run. I mean, basically, the paint just ran down the hooves of poor old Bold Personality. He had been through a terrible ordeal in the previous 24 hours. God only knows what it thought. This racing cape, this is a rum show.
So what did they do about that? That's something you would notice, I'm afraid, though, the white socks, for sure. Surely. Well, what did they do about that?
The funny thing is, most of this stuff passed muster until the race. But Hayden Hayatana decided to bandage up the legs, and they were just going to throw a rug over it and just keep the rug on as long as possible until they had to saddle it up and put a jockey on it.
What, like sounds like getting Michael Jackson into a rock concert, you just know, sort of covering with a blank, with dark glasses, Groucho Marx moustache.
That's right.
That kind of thing.
Just put a pair of sunglasses on the horse. I mean, just smuggle him in, keep the blanket on, and
no one's the wiser.
Yeah.
Do we know just how drunk these men were at this point in the morning, Jack?
These men are drinking stubbies all the way through, and they'd been drinking, and, you know, woke up that morning and looked at the red horse and go, gee, better have a stubby about this one. And that's what they were doing. They were drinking stubby after stubby after stubby, and they were due to go to Eagle Farm when they realised, we haven't put shoes on the horse. So they have to ring around, get some farriers. They need a farrier who's not going to speak up about what's going on. There's a soaking wet horse in the front yard of this guy's place. So they basically take Bold Personality, and the farrier turns up, and he doesn't have any racing plates. And he just says, look, I've got some harness racing plates, you know, that'll have to do. So poor old Bold Personality has been through so many indignities, has now been given the wrong plates to run.
So they arrive at Eagle Farm Racecourse on race day, with the bogus horse. Bold personality, tricked up with a blanket, trying to pass itself off as Fine Cotton. But yeah. did they bring the real Fine Cotton with them as well, Jack?
They had the two horses in the float. They decided that they were going to bring Fine Cotton as well, just in case they needed to pull the old switcheroo back at some point. So they got two of them there, and basically Fine Cotton spent the days racing out in the car park in the horse float.
So they get to the race course, and there's suddenly a terrifying announcement that comes through the PA. What happened, Jack?
Yes. As soon as they arrive, there's an announcement, Hayden Hyatana to the steward's room, please. Hayden Hyatana to the steward's room, please. And they all panic. I mean, they think that, oh, they've been rumbled, that's it. So Hayden fronts the steward's room, and he's told that due to a late announcement of the jockey, that he was to be fined $2. So they figure they're still going strong. But at this time, and for the preceding 48 hours, it must be said, there is a massive betting plunge going on around Australia, in Queensland, in Sydney, in Melbourne. There's money coming in on Fine Cotton. It started at its normal price of 33-1. And by the time Hyatana and the syndicate arrive at Eagle Farm, it's 7-2 favourite. And this is a massive betting plunge. At the time, a record for amount of money invested on a rank outsider in any race in Australia.
But this is only going to work if these guys have kept it a secret, Jack, isn't it? Well, so clearly a few people are in on the secret if there's been a massive plunge on the betting markets. How did the word get out?
Well, yeah, that, you're absolutely right. Secrecy is all in something like this. But everyone seemed to know. A lot of people later on got in trouble for having prior knowledge, but it seemed like hundreds of thousands of people had prior knowledge. And that essentially came from Freeman, who through his network of SPs and through all his network of people in the racing business had told them what was happening. So we have this massive, massive plunge. I mean, ideally, the syndicate would like Fine Cotton to run at perhaps 12-1, but they would have invested at perhaps 33-1. But as it turned out, Fine Cotton starts the race a raging hot favourite.
And then the conspirators see that the owner of Bold Personality, Bill Nalm, has arrived at Eagle Farm track. Now, yep. How much danger are they in at this point? He would have recognised his own horse, wouldn't he?
He's going to recognise his horse if he's a horseman. He's going to recognise his horse from half a kilometre away. He had no idea about the ring-in, of course, but his decision to turn up at Eagle Farm on that day was just completely out of the blue. And the syndicate, Gillespie, Hyatana et al., they've clocked him and gone, oh, my God, what are we going to do? So Gillespie is sort of says, leave it with me, I'll take care of this. This is my job. So he just grabs Bill Nalm and said, mate, how are you going? And pulls him into the bar and keeps him in the bar throughout the race. And while the race is being run, just keeps his head strategically in front of the TV screen so Bill Nalm won't see the race and go, gee, that's my bloody horse racing this.
Crisis averted then.
Oh, yes, so far.
Now, Jack, what was the jockey's role in all of this?
The jockey was an apprentice. His name's Gus Philpott. He's still around, still involved in the racing business. And Gus Philpott was a very late announcement for the ride. He had absolutely no idea. When he climbed on Bold Personality's back, he believed it was Fine Cotton. And, you know, when he got the mounting yard, all the jockeys, everybody else knew except for Gus. So all the jockeys are actually winking at him, going, mate, how you going? Hey, good one today, mate, no worries. And Gus really is completely clueless. He just doesn't know what's going on.
You said a lot of people found out that the fix was in. Who was seen holding Fine Cotton betting tickets at the track that day, Jack? Who was there?
Well, look, Eagle Farm would have expected a reasonable crowd in on a Saturday meeting in August, but you know, there was a big crowd in. And there were people that had never been to the races before and never would go again. And there they were standing, holding betting tickets for Fine Cotton. I mean, some of them were members of the Queensland Fraud Squad. They had prior knowledge, although the question was never actually put to them as to how they knew. But there were members of the Queensland Police and specifically Queensland Fraud Squad standing at the rails, geeing on Fine Cotton just before the race, thinking, you beauty. And they might have got on a good price too, who knows?
So then, bang.
250 metres to go.
Starter's gun fires.
He's about a neck.
And we're off to the races.
Coming at him solidly now. Fine Cotton and Harbour Gold. They're going to fight it out. Harbour Gold's just about got his nose in front. Fine Cotton's kicking again on the inside. Fine Cotton and Harbour Gold. Fine Cotton's in front. They're drawing to the line. He's just in front. Fine Cotton, Harbour Gold. Lunge right on the line. They hit it all. Gee, this is close. Pretty tight, this one. Fine Cotton or Harbour Gold. It could go either way. Then Cabaret Kingdom.
How did it end up, Jack? How did Fine Cotton place, a.k.a. Bold Personality?
Well, from the call, we know it's gone to a photo. So there would have been this long silence from everybody involved waiting for the official placings. Now, you have to bear in mind, Bold Personality has been through a hell of an equine ordeal in the previous 24 hours. It was certainly two or three classes above the rest of that field. But given the ordeal it had been through, it's stunning that it won. And it actually did come out of the gates very slowly, but the jockey got it going and it proved its class. And as you can hear from the call there, Harbour Gold did actually hit the front, probably about 50 metres from the finish line, but Bold Personality showed some fight, just stuck its nose in front. In fact, the eventual margin was a short half head, which is as close as you can get.
So then it's official. Fine Cotton has won the race. And there must have been this moment, Jack, this brief shining moment for the conspirators where all this hard work, all the switching of the horses, the rehydrating, the hair colour, henna rinse through the horse, the shoes, everything, the distraction of the horse's owner, it's paid off. So there's this brief shining moment where suddenly the conspirators think they're millionaires. How long did that moment last for, Jack?
Well, probably about 2 or 3 seconds. I mean, once the official places came down, George Freeman had sent some of his boys, flowing them up from Sydney to Brisbane, and they stood at the finish line on the rails there and started yelling out, "Ring in, ring in, ring in. Come on, stewards, wake up, wake up." And the stewards did rouse from their slumber and looked at Bold Personality. And they looked at the identification card for Fine Cotton and realised immediately that it was a different horse.
Now George Freeman had been tipped off that there was a ring in. Why would he do that? Didn't he have money on Fine Cotton? Why would he get his men to go up and shout ring in, ring in?
No, he's pulling a double sting. You see, he's decided to let these mugs, Sayers, Hayatana, Gillespie, bet on Fine Cotton. The big plunge would go on Fine Cotton. And the horse that should have started favourite, the horse that would normally be expected to win the race and start a short price favourite, Harbour Gold, would go out in the markets to 5-1. And he'd be able to pick that horse up at a very, very good price, knowing that Fine Cotton, or expecting it to be disqualified, and that Harbour Gold would be the likely second place getter, and therefore be announced the winner, which is precisely what happened. So Freeman was all over Harbour Gold, and I believe, and I was told, that he won as much as $1.5 million that day, while everyone who's on Fine Cotton, once the horse was disqualified, did their dough. Harbour Gold was named the winner, and George Freeman won $1.5 million.
That's why he was top of the heap, rather than Mick Sayers. Is it fair to say that, Jack?
He was a step ahead of your average mug punter, yes. Yes, Richard, and a step ahead of Mick Sayers, and probably 3 or 4 steps ahead of Hayden Hayatana.
So the stewards were alerted. How quickly did Hayden Hayatana, the trainer, realise the jig was up, Jack?
Well, no one's quite sure, but he was in the car park, and the announcement go, "Hayden Hayatana to the stewards' room." Came again, but this time it wasn't going to be a $2 fine. This was pretty serious. And so he jumped in the car with the horse float and Fine Cotton. Bold Personality was just left at the track and just took off. And he went into hiding for some weeks. And so did Fine Cotton, by the way. Fine Cotton went into hiding.
So this set off a massive police investigation, Jack. And this is a senior Queensland police detective at the scene of the crime.
The warrants that will be issued this afternoon will be just an action in a train, which I believe will be a long, drawn-out process to try and get to the bottom of the whole affair. It does involve a lot of people. And I tell you what, the police have done a tremendous amount of work in trying to solve and gain sufficient evidence to indeed bring justice, blitz justice to be done when these people are finally brought to trial.
As a fine member of the Queensland Police Force there at work, Jack, trying to track down the perpetrators here, saying essentially that the police would not rest until the perpetrators had been brought to trial. But didn't you just say that were members of the Queensland Fraud Squad holding betting tickets?
I'm not sure who that officer is, but if he's a member of the Queensland Fraud Squad, he's probably done his dough on fine cotton. So he is very keen to bring this syndicate to justice.
Heads will roll, indeed, when it comes to this matter. Eventually, Hayden Haitana was spotted and arrested in Renmark, South Australia.
Around midday yesterday, a man resembling Haitana aroused the suspicions of a shopper and two staff members at the Woolworth store in Renmark. Even behind a pair of dark glasses, Haitana had been recognised. Police closed in and at 6 p.m. sighted Haitana's vehicle parked outside the Truro Hotel and found him inside. Apparently he'd stopped for a drink, little realising how close he was to arrest. Security is tight because of the alleged threats on Haitana's life.
There he is, picked up near Renmark for having a drink in a pub, Jack. It's mentioned there there were fears for his life. Was his life in danger?
Well, he said so, and I have every reason to believe that that was accurate. And certainly if we remember the name of George Brown, who I mentioned at the start of the program, who was a trainer who was killed, who was murdered, then Hayden had something to worry about, definitely. But it was a nationwide search, not just for Hayden Haitana, but for Fine Cotton as well, who had also disappeared. And I just love the bit that Hayden just couldn't help himself but go into a pub disguise.
So there was an AJC inquiry into the whole affair.
Today, the AJC's committee found that bookmakers Bill and Robbie Waterhouse did have prior knowledge of the ring-in. Six others were also found to have had prior knowledge of the ring-in. They were Roman Catholic priest Father Edward O'Dwyer, bookmaker Peter McCoy, bookmaker's clerk Robert Hines...
Bookmakers Bill and Robbie Waterhouse mentioned there, Jack, as having had prior knowledge of the ring-in. How were they punished?
All of those men, including Father Ted O'Dwyer, were warned off racetracks for life. And, of course, Robbie and Bill Waterhouse were licensed bookmakers, so, you know, that means they cannot set foot on a racetrack ever again. And as bookmakers, they were unable to ply their trade.
Who was this Father Edward O'Dwyer, this Father Ted? This is the first time his name's popped up. What was his involvement?
Well, he led a massive betting plunge before the race. One of many, it must be said, but, yes, Father Ted had prior knowledge of the fine cotton ring-in, and he got life as well. He certainly had a few dollars of his own on it, and as I say, had led a massive betting plunge. But
I'm sure he would have tipped all his winnings into the poor box. I'm sure he would have.
I'm sure that's true too, Richard. Yeah.
Did anyone get a jail term out of this, Jack?
John Gillespie received the longer sentence. He was sentenced to 4 years jail. Hayden Haitana was sentenced to 12 months and served six. Obviously, both men were warned off racetracks for life, as were the other conspirators, Robert North and DeLucio. But Gillespie and Haitana were the only ones sent to jail.
This whole story feels like a story from a different Australia to me, Jack. Is that how you see it?
There is an element of that. I mean, we are talking about the final days of what we might call organised crime as it was in Australia. And the people like Freeman, McPherson, etc., they eschewed drugs, they made their money and became very powerful through the traditional illicit fare of gambling and prostitution and so forth. They weren't clean skins, but they didn't get involved in drugs at all. And of course, in this time, we are looking at the rise of heroin distribution in the country and so forth. So in a sense, it was the end of the old gangster lifestyle.
Mick Sayers, who I said had bankrolled the whole thing and was into George Freeman for anything from between half and $1.5 million on gambling debts, what became of him after the Fine Cotton affair?
Well, he was murdered about 6 months later in Sydney over an unrelated matter. He had been in contact with a heroin dealer, one of Sydney's largest, in fact the largest heroin dealer at the time, Barry McCann, and he had bought a quantity of heroin from him in a pub in the inner west, and then pulled another sort of almost fine cotton crazy story. He took the heroin from a car where he'd met McCann, went to get the money, "I'll just go and get the money, Barry," and then came back about 2 minutes later looking somewhat dishevelled, and he says, "You wouldn't believe what's happened, Barry. I've been robbed. They've stolen the heroin."
And Barry McCann was not a man to be messed with, and he said, if I don't have the heroin or my money within 24 hours, you're dead. And it took a little bit longer than that, but Sayers was murdered by associates of Barry McCann.
Where was he murdered?
He'd just been to the races, and he was murdered outside his home in the driveway of his own home. Three masked gunmen came forward, and Mick Sayers tried to run away and was shot dead in the street.
What became of George Freeman, the SP bookie kingpin? Can I call him that?
Yes, you can, absolutely. I mean, he was the king of Sydney. He was an asthmatic for most of his life. He was a smoker as well, but he had developed an addiction to pethidine and, as I say, despised drugs, but he became addicted to pethidine, and one day after an asthma attack, he just quietly died. I mean, he died in his bed. At least he died a peaceful death, unlike many other gangsters.
Hayden Haitana, he had a racetrack ban placed on him, which was finally lifted, apparently, in 2013. Do you have sympathy for Hayden Haitana?
Oh, I do. And he is one of these sort of great knockabout characters that you see around racing from time to time. Perhaps in those days, not so much now, but I did. And he was this sort of effervescent, helpful fellow. If things went wrong, oh, I'll fix that. I know how to fix that. We can do it this way. We can do it that way. I mean, he was just an immensely cooperative man. And it was very sad. I mean, you know, he was warned off racetracks for life. And, of course, Robbie and Bill Waterhouse, they appealed and after 14 years were allowed to return to racetracks and given their bookmaker's license shortly afterwards. But Hayden Haitana, whose entire life was racing, was denied the opportunity of going to a racetrack.
Finally, the horse where it all started, Fine Cotton, which disappeared along with Hayden Haitana after the fix was found out. Was it ever located? Whatever happened to Fine Cotton itself, the horse that never actually ran that day, the centre of all this fuss?
We had a nationwide horse hunt for Fine Cotton. I think about 10 weeks after the race, Fine Cotton was discovered grazing peacefully at the Queensland Mounted Police paddock, less than a couple of kilometres from Eagle Farm. There it was, sitting amongst police horses, which is really funny too. I presume Hayden Haitana had just slipped it into the paddock and thought, well, no one will notice there's an extra horse there.
Did it live to a ripe old age?
Yes, it was purchased by an Australian movie producer, John Stainton, and it actually lived a very full life and died at the ripe old equine age of 33.
And poor old Bold Personality, do we know what happened to that horse?
Well, as the check bounced, Richard, Bold Personality was returned to Bill Naum. It never raced again, and presumably after its trauma at Eagle Farm, you'd like to think it spent a happy life in a nice big paddock.
I'm amazed no one's made a major, gigantic international feature film out of this story, Jack. It's just been a great pleasure to have you tell it to us on the radio for us today. Thank you so much, Jack.
Thank you, Richard. A pleasure.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
I spoke to Peter Hoisted, a.k.a. Jack the Insider, in 2015. And now he's co-written a book with Pat Scheel called The Fine Cotton Fiasco. In the process of writing the book, he's uncovered several fresh revelations, including the presence of the mother of the then police commissioner at the track, laying a bet on that day. So I invited Jack over to my house where we recorded a Fine Cotton update. And we're going to put that in the Conversations podcast feed and on our Facebook page as well. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.